Well, that's great, you know, getting much more of a job, but you said, I was saying that the family was yesterday. That's what I'm saying. Yes, I'm sure it's the note. But I think the team has also had.
The team has got a big thing on this. I think as long as the show is.
Okay. I think we'll start. Everyone ready?
Yes.
Waiting for the robots in there. Okay, so like I said, we have a one-off today. There's some handouts over there on the end of that table. Ruth? Yeah. So just to tell you what we're doing, we having a one-off today on lessons of leadership from the Purim story. Next Thursday, in other words, we're just going to start a new series for 3 weeks. I'll send it out. I forgot what I called it, but it's about gratitude and inner freedom and those kind of things. But I'll send it out properly, which will be the next 3 weeks. So we're going to go for another 3 weeks besides today. It's a long term because it's a Jewish leap year. So we go till Pesach, just before Pesach. Next term will be a shorter term, actually, but this term is long. So we'll do that. Okay, so it's a few days before the festival of Purim. In the Jewish tradition, Purim is an extremely powerful festival. In fact, just to explain a little bit, so just for general knowledge purposes, I think I've explained this before, but the Jewish calendar is an interesting calendar. It's a lunar calendar, first of all. It goes by lunar month, a lunar cycle. Second of all, we know that we have, I know this sounds really strange, but we have Rosh Hashanah, which is called the head of the year. But actually, when we talk about the months, the first month is not the month of Rosh Hashanah. The cycle of the months actually starts from Nisan, which is the festival of Pesach. So Rosh Hashanah is the head of the year for many things. We God blesses the whole year, and it's considered the anniversary of creation and so on. But when the Jewish people were redeemed from Egypt and God gave us the mitzvah of the calendar, he actually told us that the month of Nisan, which is the month of Pesach, would be considered the first month. Now, I know that in the Torah itself, the months don't have names, right? They don't have names. It's called the first month, the second month, the third month, the fourth month. Only later, when they went into the Babylonian exile, they started to adapt names of months. In fact, in the Purim story, which is one of the last books of Tanakh, the names of the months are used, like Adar or that kind of thing. But really in the Torah, it's only first month, second month, third month. And Nisan is the first month. In fact, the month of Rosh Hashanah, the month of Tishrei, is called the seventh month. right? Even though it's Rosh Hashanah, it's an interesting system. I'm mentioning that because, for that reason, the cycle of festivals, which begins each year from anew, means that Pesach is the first festival in the cycle, right? Because it's the first month, and Purim is the last festival. And there's a lot of depth behind that because this is not the topic of today's shir, but it essentially means that when we started becoming the nation of God, because started becoming the Jewish nation, Nisan, Pesach was, we weren't ready for it. God did all the work for us. Then we had Shavuot, we got the Torah and so on. Then we have the festivals around the month of Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, has a different theme. It's a theme of Tshuva, when we start to reconnect ourselves, we do a bit of the work ourselves. But the ultimate connection, actually, we are taught in Kabbalah and in the Talmud, the ultimate connection to God actually is through the festival of Purim, right? So I know that sometimes it gets a bit ignored, the festival of Purim. People think it's a festival for kids to dress up. Yeah. But actually it's not. I mean, it is too, but it's not that at all. Purim is actually a very, very powerful day. Actually, it's the climax of the cycle of festivals throughout the year. And it manifests itself through the mitzvot of Purim and the experience of Purim and the celebration and so on and so forth. Which is why I want to urge everyone again to try and experience Purim. Don't forget Sunday morning, we have the morning Purim program at Ariella's Breeders House, 99 Wentworth Road, at 10:15. For now, we'll do a quick Megillah reading there, and then do the Mishulach Manot and a little bit of the discussion on the power of Purim. Important throughout the day to try and have a meal, a festive meal. If for whatever reason you can't make it Sunday morning, then feel free to drop into my house at 52 Anglesey Street between 12:30 and 2. I'm having a whole bunch of mostly younger people, but it doesn't matter, a big mix of people. So at least come in for a little bit and experience Purim. Okay. So the Purim story is an amazing story on many, many levels. But today what I want to talk about is leadership lessons from the Purim story. But I think it's important just to give a little bit of context. I'm not sure everyone is 100% aware, just again, for general knowledge purposes. It's important to understand the quick summary. I mean, the Megillah takes, even a very fast Megillah takes 20 minutes to read, but I'll try and give it to you in 3 minutes. So just for the purposes of the discussion today, right? So there's the Ahasuerus, he's the king of Persia. The Jews are under his rule. He rules over the whole inhabited world at the time, 127 provinces. He has this banquet where he asks Vashti to come on the seventh day. She doesn't want to come. He kills her, and Esther becomes the new queen. Esther's a Jewish queen. She doesn't tell everyone that she's Jewish, but she becomes the Jewish queen, as we'll talk about a bit later, and assumes that leadership role, both in for the Persian regime, but also ultimately for the Jewish people, together with Mordechai. Mordechai is her relative. Mordechai is the Jewish people's leader at the time. And then we have the villain of the story, Haman, who comes and he rises to great prominence and power, wants everyone to bow down to him. Mordechai refuses to bow down to him, and then he gets the Ahasuerush to enact a decree. Now, it's important to understand the decree and how this happened, the timeline, because people often mix it up. Like if I ask people, when was Haman killed? What do people normally say?
At the end
of the story, but where? What day? So often people say Purim, right? Because that's the story of Purim, the downfall of Haman. But it's actually not when it happened. The Yahrzeit of Haman is actually the second day Pesach. Right? You know that? In fact, some people have a custom to like add a kugel or something, an extra dish on the second day Pesach to celebrate the downfall of Haman. So if that's the case, what's Purim? So it's important to understand the actual story of how Purim plays out. So Haman wanted to kill the Jewish people. What he did was he drew lots. He drew lots to discover which would be the best day to kill all the Jewish people, right? Now, when he drew the lots, it was just a couple of weeks before Pesach. And it came out that the Jewish people are all going to be annihilated on the 13th of Adar, which is the day before Purim, right? So, in other words, imagine this. It wasn't even 2 weeks before Pesach. It was like a week and a half before Pesach. He draws lots. It's the month of Nisan. That in 12 months from now, on the 13th of Adar, there's a decree that every anti-Semite in the inhabited world can take up arms and kill Jews. That's essentially what the decree was, right? The word gets out. Mordechai is obviously upset. Mordechai jumps into action, starts to pray to God, gathers the Jewish people, gathers children, says, in order to learn Torah and reconnect to God. He understands this as not just a physical thing, he understands it as a spiritual thing, that somehow something's gone wrong in the relationship between the Jewish people and God. Call to action, everyone should really reflect and reconnect, and the Jews spring into action. One of the things that happens is that Mordechai sends a message to Esther, you've got to go to the king and intercede, right? You're the one in the palace, you've got to do that, right? So she says, but there's a problem because it's illegal for me to go to the king right now because I haven't been called to the king for 30 days. And if I go to the king, one of two things is going to happen. Either he's going to stick out his scepter, his golden scepter, which means it's a sign that it's okay to come, or he's going to kill me, right? Because I wasn't invited, even though she was his wife. But that's the way it worked with the kings of old times, right? But he says, okay, but you're the one that's got to go. So she says, I'm going to go only on one condition. That first you call all the Jews of Shushan. Shushan was the capital, right? And call all the Jews, and they need to have a three-day fast. Now, it happened to be, by the way, that three-day fast went over the first night of Pesach. So that year, the Jews did not have a Seder, right? Fascinating midrash about Mordechai says, but it's the Seder. Like, we're not going to have Pesach if you do this, right? And she says, well, if there's no Jews, there's no Pesach. So you need Jews, right? And she understood that there needs to be a fast day, a fast three-day fast, a lot of davening, a lot of learning, and Mordechai does that. So she goes, he goes, and he calls this fast, 3 days, all the Jews gather, they reconnect to Hashem. Part of the reason that came about, says, is because they were too reliant on, a lot of similarities, by the way, to what's happening today as well. They were much, much too reliant on the politicians at the time, because they went to the feast of Ahasuerus, and they thought that's going to be their protection. God said, you need to rely on God, not on Ahasuerus' protection, right? I think we know the lesson today very well. There's no one to rely on anymore. So we know we only rely on God, and he'll bring it about. So anyway, but they daven. Mordechai says in the Medrash, he gathers 22,000 children, because the power of children is very strong, in order to call out to Hashem and to learn Torah and to daven and so on. And on the third day, Esther goes to the king, right? And she says to him, and he says, and he welcomes her, and he says, well, it's part of the miracle. What do you want? He says, I want you and Haman to come to a banquet that I prepared for you that day. So the first day, Pesach, sometime during the day, they gather at Esther's quarters and they have this banquet. And at the banquet, Ahasuerus says to Esther, so what do you want? She says, you know what? I want you to come back tomorrow for another party. Right? And then tomorrow I'll tell you what I want. And there's a whole story that night. The king couldn't sleep. And they read from him from the Book of Chronicles. And they found out that Mordechai had once saved the king, but he wasn't rewarded. And that minute, Haman comes and he's going to tell the king that he wants to just hang Mordechai because he's fed up with him. And he comes and he ends up parading Mordechai around Shushan and Oros to reward him. And that's the beginning of the downfall of Haman. The next afternoon, they come to the banquet of Esther, and Ahasuerus says, what do you want? And she exposes Haman. This was the second day of Pesach, right? She exposes Haman and says, he wants to destroy my people. We're asking the king, please have mercy. And Ahasuerus says, who's this person? And Esther says, it's him, it's Haman. Anyway, he gets very angry and he has Haman hanged. Second day Pesach. So that's when Haman was hanged. Now there's a problem, right? So everything turns around. But Ahasuerus then turns to Esther and Mordechai and says, I can't actually undo this decree. Now don't forget, there's still this decree hanging over the head, right? That in 11 months, 12 months from then, on the 13th of Adar, there's going to be a war and people are going to kill Jews. And that Ahasuerus says, I have a problem. I actually can't undo that decree because under Persian rule, I guess when it suits him, under Persian rule, once a decree is signed by the king, you can't undo it. But he says, what I could do is, follow me, I can allow you to make another decree that will allow Jews to take up arms and fight back. Because until then, the decree was that they wouldn't have arms. Only the non-Jews would have arms and they would kill the Jews. But they can fight back. That you can do. That's a fascinating thing because that means for almost 11 and a half months, or 11 months at least, almost, by 11 months, they had this hanging over their head, right? Now, it does say in the Megillah that people saw that things are turning towards the favor of the Jews, that some people abandoned their plan. But anti-Semites don't die, right? So what happens is, a lot of people, they're still going to fight, right? They're aware that there was another decree, a counter-decree, but there was going to be war, and there was a war. And the war was 11 months later, after Haman long gone, The war was 11 months later on the 13th of Adar, and the Jews won the war, right? A number of anti-Semites fell that day, no one fell from the Jewish people, and the Jews completely were victorious and won the entire war. And the next day they celebrated 14th of Adar, which is Purim. So Purim is actually the victory of the war, not the demise of Aman. Aman was, it's all part of the same story, but right, the Megillah that we read on Purim actually takes 11 years. It's over a period of 11 years. Which is why sometimes it's difficult to see the miracle in it. So that's why we call it a hidden miracle. Because you got a piece, you know, because, yeah, and if you do it very quickly, you can see how everything's falling into place. But over 11 years, a lot of stuff just seemed coincidental. You understand? So it wasn't like, you know, Vashti was killing, Esther becomes the queen, but it was all disconnected. I mean, Haman was many years later. But that's Purim. Okay, so that's the Purim story in a nutshell. Now, back to the topic of today. So, leadership lessons from the Megillah. Because one of the, and I think it's an important topic, because one of the things that we've talked about a couple of years ago when we did a series on leadership is that leadership lessons are not only for leaders, because everyone's a leader, meaning we all have a circle of influence, right? Every person has a circle of influence. It might be their family, it might be friends, it might be a teacher in a classroom, whatever. I mean, there are many, many different forms of leadership, but leadership is something we all have, right? We all have to show by example, we all have to lead on some level. So, the traits that we talk about leaders having to have is something that everyone has to have. And what we'll see is, in our own personal circle of influence, how we inspire the people, how we lead other people, right? Leadership doesn't always mean power, it doesn't mean authority necessarily, but it means the capacity to inspire those who we have a connection with and those who we could inspire. And we'll see some of the things I want to talk about today is actually very relevant in terms of what we're going through today. So, here it is. I want to go through six ideas, okay? First is a general idea, and that is that the purpose of leadership is a dual purpose. And again, that goes for everyone. If we have someone that we have influence over or we can have an impact over. On the one hand, leadership means to challenge other people. That's what leadership is. We challenge people to grow, to go out of their comfort zone. I once heard, someone told me that the role of a rabbi is to make uncomfortable people comfortable and comfortable people uncomfortable. Yeah. I kind of like that. But at the same time, a leader's purpose, and I think that's so important now, is to bring light and to instill hope. Right? Although sometimes when we challenge people, it almost sounds like we make things difficult and we overwhelm people and think, oh, well, how can I do that? And how can, you know? Our role is to give hope, to give light, to give positivity. So we see that in the Megillah story. Esther and Mordechai, just in the story I just told you, on the one hand, they challenged the people. When the decree came about that they were going to be annihilated, you have to understand it was a very dark time, right? Extremely dark time. Because the Jews had nowhere to run. It's interesting, throughout history, when there was persecution, one of the things we have is that when there was persecution against Jews in a country, there were sometimes Jews in another country that weren't under that persecution and were able to provide assistance, were able to give help, even during the Holocaust, right, which is one of the worst atrocities against Jewish people in history, but there was some hope in terms of where they could go, right, afterwards. Some people escaped, they went to America, went to Israel, it wasn't easy, but In the threat of Purim was a threat of the entire Jewish nation, wherever they were, with nowhere to run. So it was a very, very dark time for them. And yet, what Esther and Mordechai did was both things. First of all, they challenged the Jewish people. That's what she said. Gather the Jewish people. They need to intensify their connection to God. They need to recalibrate their relationship with God. They need to reconnect. They have to come back. They should intensify their efforts. They challenged them. But at the same time, they showed them tremendous help and faith. I want to just interject here with a very fascinating story that the Talmud tells about the ability to instill hope. Talmud tells a story that on the surface is a very strange story, but there's a lot of depth in the story. It's a story about the great Rabbi Akiva, right? One of the greatest Talmudic sages ever, lived under Roman rule, time of great persecution for the Jewish people. And his whole personality was to teach Torah, right? And he taught, and he's one of the great authors of what we know today as the Oral Torah. And it says Rabbi Akiva was once giving a shiur to his students, and they're beginning to fall asleep. It's not just a modern problem. It's an age-old problem, it looks like, right? They're beginning to fall asleep. So he decided, this is the way the story reads, but it actually reads on a much deeper level, which I'll share with you in a minute. But so he decided he's got to interrupt the shiur and say something light, just to wake them up a little bit, right? That's what people do, you know? Some little joke in the middle, whatever, you know, that kind of thing, right? So he suddenly stopped his shiur. Obviously, it was a shiur in some great in-depth halachic analysis or Talmudic analysis, whatever the shiur was about. And he stopped the shiur and he asked him a question. He says, does anyone know why Esther, in the Purim story, had the merit to rule over 127 provinces? And everyone looked at him, oh, that's an interesting question, why? So he answered and he said, because she was a descendant of Sarah, our matriarch Sarah, Abraham's wife, who lived for 127 years. End of story. So all the commentaries ask the story, first of all, what's the, like, that's a funny connection. I mean, we're all descendants of Sarah, like, why particularly Esther, right? Second of all, like, Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest teachers ever. What do you mean they fell asleep in the middle? Yeah, maybe you fall asleep and someone is giving a boring shiur or something. But these were great sages. Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim were not just people who, you know, arrived in shul because they had to come that day for a bar mitzvah or something, and therefore the rabbi wasn't going on a bit long and it wasn't so relevant, so they fell asleep. Rabbi Akiva was a tremendous sage, and they were tremendous dedicated students, right? Doesn't seem right that his students would fall asleep in the middle of his lecture. What does that mean? And second of all, what he said wasn't so funny and wasn't so engaging. I mean, okay, it was like off the topic a little bit, but how did they wake him up? So some of the commentaries explain the story in a whole different way, and they say like this. Rabbi Akiva was giving a lecture, it was a time of great persecution. Roman rule, real, real terrible persecution was going on. It was just after the destruction of the Second Temple. I mentioned this at the event that we had. Rabbi Akiva and his students said that although the temple's destroyed, but we still have our anchor, we still have study, we still have knowledge, we still can learn, we still can connect. And when the Romans realized that that's actually true, that the Jewish people, notwithstanding the destruction of the temple, are still thriving because they have centers of learning and they're connecting, they realized they made a mistake. The temple wasn't the problem. It was the education was the problem, so they decided to ban education. Right? So Rabbi Akiva lived in a time where to teach Torah in public was a criminal offense, punishable by death, right? Which eventually Rabbi Akiva was tortured to death, along with nine other sages. So he's giving this lecture, and it's in the context of the time. Says the Medrash, says the Talmud, they started to fall asleep. What does that mean? Rabbi Akiva noticed that they're not falling asleep from the lecture. They're falling asleep, meaning they're losing hope. They're losing their passion. They're starting to get tired. They're starting to lose hope. That's what it means, we're falling asleep. And he says, and he thinks to himself, he has to give them hope. And he asks him a question. He said, why did Esther rule over 127 provinces? And he gave the answer, because Sarah lived 127 years. What does that mean? So the commentaries explain, when the Torah tells us how long Sarah lived, there's a very interesting expression. It says like this. It's one of the early portions in the Torah. It says, Vayu chaye Sarah. The life of Sarah was 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. Right? That's the reading of the Pasuk. And then the Pasuk repeats, Shnei chaye Sarah. These are the years of Sarah. So there's a whole bunch of commentary in the Talmud and so on. What does it mean? 100 years, 20 years. Why don't we just say 127 years? But more important for this discussion, what's the repetition at the end? If I say, the years of Sarah was 127, these are the years of Sarah. That's a repetition, right? So the Talmud tells us that when Rashi brings it down in the Chumash as well, that when the Pasuk ends with the words, these are the years of Sarah, it means that they were all equal. And the expression that's used is an amazing expression. The expression that uses is, Kulan shavin letova. They were all equally good. All equally good. That's what it means. And of course, the commentaries ask the question, how can you say that Sarah's years were all equally good? They actually were not all equally good. Some were very tough years. When they moved from Haran to Israel, They had to leave Israel, go down to Egypt because it was a famine. When they came down to Egypt, Sarah was abducted. She was kidnapped by Pharaoh's and his men. Pharaoh threatened to violate her. God protected her, but it was a very, very tough time. Then the whole story, she couldn't have children. She, as much as she tried, she was childless for many, many years. And then she decided, you know what, she'll give her maidservant to Abraham. And she'll be like a surrogate. She'll raise a son, Ishmael, who Sarah will help raise. He turned out to be a disaster at the time. And Hagar was a bit of a disaster. Yeah, still a disaster, big disaster, yeah. Right? And Hagar was disrespectful to her. And then eventually Yitzchak is born. And Yitzchak grows up, and then Ishmael is still in the house, and he's fighting with Yitzchak. He's threatening Yitzchak, right? So her she had a tough life. Some good parts, but it was a very tough life. Yet the Torah tells us these are the years of Sarah Kulan Shavina Tova. Why? Because Sarah was that individual, the Zohar says, that was able to give meaning and purpose and hope and positivity to any experience. It's not that all her years were in fact equal, it was that she made all her years equal. She was able to make the dark times, she was able to discover the light in the dark times. Right? That's a difficult thing to do. To see light in darkness is a very difficult thing to do. Because when you see, we've talked about this many times, but when you bring light into the darkness doesn't necessarily go away, which means the pain might still be there. And yet, Sarah was that individual. The Zohar says she did what previous generations couldn't do. She was able to bring an amazing level and depth of joy into the world, says the Zohar, because she was able to bring that positivity. She was able to see the meaning. She was able to see the purpose, the positive, the light in every single experience. Says Rabbi Akiva to his students, that's why Esther ruled over 127 provinces. Because Esther also lived in a very dark time. 127 provinces was the whole world at the time. It was the all inhabited world. And when the darkness came about, when Haman decreed that all the Jews were going to be annihilated, that was every single Jew that threatened the entire existence of the Jewish nation. And yes, Esther challenged the Jewish people, but she also brought hope. She was also able to bring hope. She was also able to stay above it and be positive and encourage them and say, you do what you need to do, and I'm going to trust in Hashem. And in fact, let me just share with you a beautiful midrash based on a chapter of Tehillim. I don't know if you know this, but when King David wrote Psalms, there's 150 Psalms in Tehillim, right? So most of them are written by King David himself, and it's about King David. A lot of them are about King David and his experiences. But we know that King David wrote Psalms prophetically. And many of them refer to future stories that were going to happen to the Jewish people. There's one particular psalm, Psalm 22. If you look at it, it's a very beautiful psalm. And it's a psalm which King David wrote prophetically about Esther. It starts off that this is a psalm for Ayelet HaShachar, the morning star. What's the morning star? The morning star is it says just before it gets light in the day, it's very dark. And that's the time of Esther. Ayelet HaShachar refers to Esther, the Talmud says. And there's words which Esther ended up using. What was the story? The story was like this. I told you the story about, I gave you the synopsis of the story of Purim, right? So the third day after the fast, Esther gets dressed and she's going to the palace of Mordechai, the part of the palace where Ahasuerus was, the king was. She walks into that palace, and Esther was she was a prophetess, we're told. And she always had with her the spirit of Hashem. She walks into the palace, and as she's making her way through to come to the chamber, the throne room where Ahasuerus is sitting, she feels God leaving her. That's what it says. She feels the spirit of God leaving her. Part of it, the Medrash says, has to do with the fact that in Ahasuerus' palace, they were full of getchkes, they were full of idols. And because Ahasuerus was a pagan worshiper, right? And she turns to God and she says, it's all in chapter 22 of Tehillim, you can check it out, it's beautiful words. She says, Keili, Keili, lama azaftani. God, God, why are you forsaking me? Why are you leaving me? This is the time I need you. And she starts to panic. And then right afterwards she says, no, I have faith, I have trust. And she says, B'cha batchu avotenu, in you our forefathers have always trusted. B'tchu v'atfaltemo, They've trusted in you and they've been saved. And I'm going to do the same. You're leaving me, but I know you're not leaving me. It's dark, but I know you're still here. You seem to have abandoned me, but you haven't abandoned me. Because I trust in you and I'm going to keep trusting in you. Again, it was a very dark moment, maybe the darkest moment. And yet, she's still finding the light. She's still being positive. And it works. She goes to Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus welcomes her. And the banquets happen and the Haman is exposed. And the salvation comes, right? So that's part of what we need to do. And I think, and I wanted to share this with you because it's not just enough to have hope, right? It's not enough to have hope. We have to all be leaders in this. We have to inspire hope in other people. We have to inspire hope in others. A lot of people are losing hope. A lot of people are despairing. I keep hearing people saying how dark it is and how unsettled they are. And like I said last week, there's what to be despair about. I mean, you know, when our friends have abandoned us, so it becomes uncomfortable, right? But we can't do that. I just heard, Dina sent this to me yesterday, my wife Dina, there's the most amazing things that we find. I mean, we are living in a very dark time, but there's the most inspiring moments. So there was an interview. Sorry, it wasn't an interview, it was a lecture actually. Some big event in a shul in America where someone by the name of Sapir Cohen, I don't know if you heard the name, Sapir Cohen is one of the hostages who was released. She was in Gaza, I think, for over 50 days. One of the early hostages, a youngish girl. And she speaks, so it's in two parts. She speaks for like 10 minutes and then two people who run a podcast interviewed her and asked her questions. It's beyond incredible. First of all, she tells a crazy story that a while before October the 7th, she had some sort of fear, she had some sort of anxiety, and she thought it was that maybe she has a health issue. And she went to doctors and that, right? And I couldn't find anything wrong with her, but she was very anxious. And a friend told her, there's a certain chapter in Tehillim you've got to say for 40 days, right? And she started saying that chapter of Tehillim, and only towards the end she realized it's got nothing to do with... She wasn't concentrating on the words, even though she's Israeli, but it's classical Hebrew, she didn't understand necessarily everything. And she realized only when she was captured that it actually had nothing to do with health. It's chapter 27 in Tehillim, which is about war, not about health. And over there, it's all about trusting in Hashem. In Tachanel, like Machaneh, King David says, there could be a war against me and everyone can abandon me, but I will not fear because I trust in you. It's like amazing, amazing. It's the one we say in Elul, before Rosh Hashanah. We say that a lot, right? Anyway, that was just an amazing thing. I don't know what that means. But anyway, she, amazing, positive. Even in Gaza, she was amazingly positive. She was there with a much younger hostage. She tried to give her hope and she thanked Hashem that she was alive. And the most amazing thing. And then she tells a story. She must have an amazing mother. Her mother, she herself doesn't look like she was very religious, although very fascinating enough, as a thanks to Hashem which came out of Gaza, she started now keeping Shabbos, which is amazing. And she tells a story like this, that when she was in Gaza, her mother was bringing a group of women every day to her house for a few hours to study, to learn Torah, right? I can imagine, it's the mother of a hostage in Gaza, right? And the women would come and they would gather like 15 women every day and study in her merit. And the women used to come, like upset, sad, dejected, right? And the mother refused to have it. So mother started putting on music. This is the mother of a child in Gaza, right? She started putting on music. She says she wants only positive energy because she knows that positive energy is going to be very good for her daughter. And you can check it out. Sapir Cohen, her name is. And I think it's the most amazing idea, right? She was able to do that. A real Esther, a real, in the moment of unbelievable darkness and almost despair. And it's not just that we, in a way, we live today in even a bigger darkness than the Purim story because we're not just under threat. Things have happened already, right? People have died. Many, many people. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. 1,200 on Simchat Torah and so many soldiers and hostages and so forth, right? So we're in a bigger darkness, but we can't lose hope. And it looks so dark now because everyone's abandoning us, like Esther says in Tehillim. But nevertheless, we don't lose hope. Not only shouldn't we lose hope, but we need to inspire hope in other people. We need to fight that darkness and be positive and believe in Hashem and strengthen our Jewishness and try to do more than we can before and try to upgrade our connection to Hashem and lead by example, show other people hope, inspire other people to create what she calls that positive energy. Okay. On a different topic, another very interesting lesson of leadership from the Megillah, which I thought was interesting, is when we assume leadership, we have to lead strongly. But we shouldn't pursue leadership and fame and powerful and power for our own gain, which is not the culture of today's society, right? Politicians generally pursue leadership for their own purpose, for their own honor, for their own glory, right? It's very rare to find someone that really is there altruistically. So we find an amazing thing with Esther, right? You know, the story of the Megillah is that after Vashti was killed, so Ahasuerus, not being a terribly immoral person, he had this beauty competition, right, to see who's going to pick as his queen. That's part of the story of the Megillah, the beginning, second chapter. And all these, and it's a whole thing, all these girls essentially gather, and many of them are very, very enthusiastic. They want to become the queen. Now, you know, in Tanakh, and Esther was taken also against her will. She didn't want to do it, but she was taken also. And they were all housed in this place where there was people who were in charge of them, and they would prepare them to go to the king. And each one would go to the king for one day, one night, whatever, and then he would decide who he's going to take, right? Politicians of Persian time. Okay, so you know, in the Tanakh and in the Torah, there's a tune that we read, like, you know, you go to Shul on Shabbat, there's a tune that the Torah is read with, right? So in the how do we know the tune? It's something called, they call it in Yiddish, the trop, which means the notations. If you look in a Chumash, you'll see there's vowels underneath the words. There's also these little notes, right? If you know how to read it. Now, the Torah itself doesn't have notes, nor does the Megillah, because you're supposed to read it from parchment. So you memorize it, right? You have to learn it. You have to learn the tune. But in the text, in the Chumash, there's notes, and each note has a name. And the Talmud tells us that these notes, these musical notes that are there for the Megillah or for the Torah, are very deep. They all have significance. They all have some spiritual symbolism, right? And the Vilna Gaon was one of the people that he used to interpret this a lot, and he would say that it's got a lot to do with the names of the notes. So, I'll just share with you a very fascinating idea. There's two verses in the Megillah. One is describing about when it would come the turn of each of these maidens to go into Ahasuerus, then they would go, and then they would come back, and they would go one night, they come back the next morning, then Ahasuerus would tell them if they've been accepted or rejected, right? The notes on so it says, Uvahagia tor na'ara v'na'ara. When the turn came for each girl to come, what's the notes? The notes is something called kadma v'azla. It's like two semicircles, right? And that has a certain tune. But the word kadma v'azla means moving, jumping forward. That's what it means. It's an Aramaic term. Means jumping forward. Why is that the notes on that pasuk? Because all the other girls were rushing for this. They couldn't wait. Right? They were pursuing. Why? It would be good for them. Can you imagine becoming the queen of Persia? Can you imagine becoming the queen of 127 provinces? The power, the fame, the riches, right? And so on. When it comes to Esther, fascinating verse, it says, when the turn of Esther came. And for like 5-6 words, there's a note, some of the notes are top of the word, some of the notes are underneath the word. This one's underneath. There's like in a row, like 5 times in a row, there's this little sort of half a square that's called munach. Uvehagia, tor, Esther, bat, avichai. Right? And what is it? What does munach mean? Stop, rest. Because when Esther went, she was very hesitant. Uvehagia, she didn't want to go. She had to be pushed, right? Because she wasn't interested. When she was thrust into it under the guidance of Mordechai, she took it seriously, and she was able to help the Jews. She did, but she wasn't looking for it. Moshe Rabbeinu himself, the greatest Jewish leader, stood at the burning bush arguing with God for 7 days. He said to me, "I don't want this. Right? I don't want this." And that's a lesson that we need to understand why because leadership is not for us. Same thing like with parents. This is one of the parenting fundamentals that people often miss. We don't bring up kids so that we should have nachas. Like Rabbi Tversky says, children are not nachas machines. We bring up children as a responsibility, and they're all different. It's not about creating clones. It's about imparting values, sharing values the best we can, and bringing them up the best we can, but it's about doing what's right for them, not doing what's right for us. Right? And it's often very different. So that's a hesitancy, that's a big responsibility. It takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of self-growth. Esther's not rushing for it. Everyone else is. Let's become a famous politician. Esther says, no, Vagia, Tor, Munach, stop. Connected to that is also the concept of humility. A leader, needs to know that sometimes they need to learn from others, not do everything themselves, not make those decisions. A true leader, even though they might be the ultimate authority, but a leader has to be a person that is willing to learn, willing to take guidance, willing to take mentorship from other people, willing to not take credit for everything themselves, but to build a team. How do we see that in the Megillah? In a very fascinating way. In the Purim story, there's a very interesting detail. Early on, after Esther became the queen, there were two officers of the king Ahasuerus called Bigthan and Seresh. And they didn't like the king very much, and they were plotting to kill the king. Now, they were talking because there were many languages at the time, they were talking in an unknown language amongst themselves, plotting. They thought no one understands. The problem is that when they were talking, Mordechai was around, and Mordechai, before the temple was destroyed, was a member of the Sanhedrin. And it was the law that anyone as a member of the Sanhedrin had to be proficient in all the languages, had to be very, very linguistic, one of the qualifications of Sanhedrin. So he understood it. He knew exactly what they were doing, plotting to the king. And Esther was already in the palace, so he told Esther. By the way, Mordechai was also in the palace of Ahasuerus. He was an officer, right? There were Jews in Babylonian exile, particularly there were Jews who were involved in governmental issues. So he told Esther to go and tell the king. So there's a very fascinating verse that says, "Vatomer Esther, Esther went to tell the king in the name of Mordechai that there's a plot happening, and Ahasuerus found out, and he had them killed, and he saved his life, right? In the name of Mordechai." And it was recorded that way. They have a book of chronicles, and it was recorded that way. Fast forward a number of years, that night between the two banquets when Ahasuerus couldn't sleep, and Haman is all pleased with himself that he's been invited, and he's annoyed with Mordechai, won't bow down to him, and he decides, you know what, before this day that we're going to kill all Jews, we'll have Mordechai hang now. And he's on the way to the palace to tell the king that he's about to hang Mordechai. And the king can't sleep, and he calls someone to read from the book of Chronicles to wake him up, to put him to sleep a little bit, right? And they open to the page, one of the parts of the miracle, and it's a story of Mordechai who told Esther that there's a plot against him. And it says there that Esther told her the name of Mordechai. So Ahasuerus says to the guys reading the book, and what does it say? How was Mordechai rewarded? So he answers, it doesn't say, there was no reward. And at that moment, Haman walks in. And at that point, already Ahasuerus is nervous and he's tensed and he's stressed. And he says to Haman, thanks for coming. He's not interested in what Haman has to say. He says, tell me, what do you think should be done to someone who saved the king's life? Someone who really want to honor the king, right? And Haman's thinking to himself, because he was a narcissist, he's thinking, probably means me, right? So he says, oh, you know what? I think that person should be dressed in royal garbs, in royal garments. Even the crown of the king maybe should be put on his head, and it should be paraded through the streets on a horse, a royal horse, with someone there screaming, this is what's done to someone who the king wants to honor. Ahasuerus says, great, don't do that to Mordechai. And he's completely baffled, right? He lost the right. And then that's when the tide changed. So the Perkei Avot says that when you say something to someone that you heard from someone else, you must say it in the name of the person you heard it. Right? Kol ha'omer, anyone who says something to someone else in the name of the person that you heard it, brings redemption to the world. The proof is, because Esther said the name of Mordechai, right? So the commentary explains, not just about the sequence of the story, it's about great leadership. Esther didn't want to take the credit for herself, because a leader doesn't do that. Right? Because it's not a weakness to say, you know, I heard this from someone else. If we share an idea with someone and you say, you know what, I heard this from someone else, but I'd love to push this idea. Someone told me this idea, it's an amazing idea, why don't we implement it? That's not a weakness, that's a strength. It's a symbol of someone who's prepared to learn and listen to other people. So one of the great lessons of leadership we learn from the Megillah is that a leader has to build a team and not be afraid to say, I didn't come up with this idea myself. It's not original. Because a true leader is not someone who can think of everything themselves. A true leader is someone that can listen to others. And that's part of the humility, part of the understanding the responsibility of leadership is to look out, where can I hear from other people, where can I learn, where can I pick from other people. Okay. Two short things until I get to the last one. Number four, number five. Mordechai, moving to Mordechai, not just Esther. Esther of Mordechai, also a great leader, right? So one of the things, the Mordechai, at the very end of the Megillah, when we sum up the story, the Megillah tells us two things about Mordechai, almost two opposite things, but they're both true. They're both important. The first is the Resh Tov La'amo, that Mordechai was someone who only sought the good of his people. A true leader bats for his flock. A true leader goes out on a limb for the people that he's leading, or she's leading, right? Like Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, when the Jews made him upset, when they served the golden calf, when they got into trouble, when they didn't listen, and they didn't wait for him, and they didn't believe in him, and God said, I've had enough of these people, I'm going to destroy them. Moshe Rabbeinu says, you destroy them, take my name out of the Torah. Right? He challenged God. Because a true leader does that. A true leader will not only, you know, sometimes leaders today, they're into building their own fortune, their own fame, their own legacy. Exactly. A leader doesn't do that. A true leader, Mordechai was there for everyone he was leading. Right? They were good, they weren't good, they liked him, they didn't like him. He was there for them. That's a leader. On the other hand, the fascinating thing, at the end of the Megillah, there's this phrase like snuck in there at the end that says that Mordechai was a person who was Ratsui L'Rov Echav. He was accepted and beloved by most of his brethren. Why not? That's not such a compliment. How about all of them? That he was like Mr. Popular. Because the answer is that leadership also takes strength. You have to put yourself out for every person that you lead, but at the same time understand that leadership is not a popularity contest. Leadership is about imparting values. Leadership sometimes takes strength, and leadership means sometimes you got to say no and you got to do something that's very unpopular. This is true for parents, it's true amongst friends, it's true for any circle of influence that we have. Sometimes we got to be true to things that we believe in, even if it's unpopular. Which leads into the very last lesson that we learn from Mordechai. The idea of conviction, the idea of values, the idea of principles. Which is very, very fascinating, because if you read the story of the Megillah, it almost sounds like the trouble came because of Mordechai. And in fact, at the time, there were those that accused Mordechai of that. But in fact, on the deeper level, he was not the problem, he was the solution. Let me explain. So the decree of Haman came about because Haman, when he rose to fame, he had this thing where everyone needs to bow down to him, right? And people started doing that. And there's different commentaries, some of the commentaries in the Talmud says that he not only was about bowing down to him, but it was about bowing down to what he believed in. Some say he even had a picture of a little model of an idol that was part of the problem as well. Whatever the case was. But everyone thought, you know, this is what we've got to bow down to. The only one that wouldn't bow down to him was Mordechai. And at the time, that was an incredibly unpopular decision. To the point where people accused Mordechai and said, you're bringing hate upon us. And then when the decree happened, some people said to Mordechai, you see, it's all your fault. Right? But it was wrong. Why was it wrong? Because Mordechai understood that actually he's not the problem. The reason that the decree of Haman came about is because Jews lost their pride. They lost their connection. They lost their values. They lost their conviction. When he stood up to Haman, Haman was afraid because Haman saw that maybe it's going to be difficult to destroy the Jewish people because there's this one leader that's not lost, hasn't lost anything. But he was the only one. And Haman gets angry, and Haman gets threatened. And Haman gets Ahasuerus to agree to destroy the Jewish people. Now, you have to understand how difficult this must have been for Mordechai, right? Mordechai understood that's the wrong thing to bow down to Haman. It wasn't just the physical bowing down to him and saying good morning like the Japanese do. It was more about the symbol behind it. It's more about cowering to the social pressure, the political pressure of an anti-Semite. That's what it was about. Cowering to the spiritual threat to the Jewish people. Not being proud, not standing tall. But no one listened to Mordechai. Can you imagine how hard it was for Mordechai to be the only one in the entire nation that was of this belief, that didn't bow down to Haman, right? Not only didn't that bow down, but he did it with great emphasis. It's very interesting. The verse in the Megillah that says that he didn't bow down, says everyone was bowing down to Haman wherever he would go. And then it says, Mordechai lo yichra velo yishtachave, which literally means he did not bow down and he didn't acquiesce, didn't bend down, right? But if you look at the grammar of that verse, it's an interesting grammar. It doesn't say he didn't bow down in the past tense. That would have been in Hebrew, that would say lo kara, he didn't bow down, not lo yichra. If you know Hebrew, the yud in front of a word makes it the future tense. Lo yichra velo yishtachave. He wasn't going to bow down and he wasn't going to bend, right? It's a very funny verse, grammatically. And some of the commentators explain that what it means is it's there for emphasis. In other words, not just that it means he practically didn't bow down, but he was ambivalent about it. Lo yichra, he was never going to bow down. It was so strong within himself. He was so strong in his conviction and his values that it wasn't just a practical thing he didn't bow down. He never entertained the thought of even thinking of bow down. That's what the future tense comes to kind of reveal and emphasize, right? And I thought I'd bring that in towards the end because I think this is maybe the whole Megillah is so relevant now, but I think maybe this is the most relevant pasuk, right? We are and we have to be like Mordechai today, nowadays. Because we are against an entire world. It is that way. Right? I mentioned the beginning, I mentioned last week. This is the way it is. We have very, very few friends. One Douglas Murray is coming to Sydney. Everyone's getting excited. Why is everyone getting excited? He actually says things that are just very logical because he's the only one that's saying it. That's why. Right? If everyone would have a head screwed on, then he wouldn't be popular because everyone would just say the same thing. Right? He's popular because he's going against the grain. He's a good friend. Right? Okay, but most of the world's not like him. Right? I mean, it's unbelievable. You listen to the stuff and you listen to the nonsense. You listen to, right? I mean, I don't like to talk politics, but I just was amazed. Like you know, the President of the United States is telling us what to do. And he's saying, you know, amazing thing I realized the other day, I mean, I realized a long time ago, but like, sorry, no offense to the United States, but, right? Yeah. You know, people say words that sound good and everyone just buys the words without thinking what they actually mean, right? So you say fancy words, like he sits there and says, you know, it's very important to destroy Hamas, but we've got to find an alternative. And it sounds very good, right? So everyone listens and nods their heads. And like, yes, finish a sentence. Could you please explain to us what the alternative is? Like, I'm sure Prime Minister of Israel would like to also know. I mean, just rubbish, right? So I'm just bringing an example how the whole world is, it's very hard. Anti-Semitism is on the rise. And we are... It's very normal and very logical for us to worry and to have fear and to cower and to retreat. And the story of Purim teaches us the salvation came about because of Mordechai, not the trouble. Because he stood strong, eventually the Jews realized he was right and they flocked around him to adopt his perspective and to reconnect to God with tremendous pride and tremendous identity and tremendous strength. And I think there's no better time now. Before Purim, we've got a few days to go to Purim. This is what we have to do. We have to be so strong within ourselves. We have to be proud Jews. We have to have a proud identity. And we have to engage in our Jewishness more. I think, and I've said this a few times, but I think this is really now before Purim. It's an opportune time. In fact, today is called the Fast of Esther. Right? It's a special day, a very auspicious day. Saturday night and Sunday is Purim. Now's the time to think about what can we do to be more Jewish. You know, I've mentioned things before. Maybe we can light Shabbos candles on time. Maybe we can do another mitzvah. Maybe we can just be proud. Especially also to engage in the mitzvot of Purim. Don't let Purim just pass. Engage in the Purim. Engage in it. Because it's really the story of us. It's our story. The greatness of the story of Purim is that it's a festival of that happened in darkness, not like Pesach. Pesach, when the Jews left Egypt, it was miracles after miracle. 10 plagues, spilling in the Red Sea. God was revealed. God was exposed. It was obvious. Purim is our story. Purim is when it looks dark. And in the darkness, suddenly the light comes through. Right? So we have to be like Mordechai. That's the lesson. Let's be a Mordechai. Lo yichrav, lo yishtachve, not to bow down, not to acquiesce, not to cower, but to stand tall, stand proud, and express that pride by engaging more in who we really are. Give expression to our soul, give expression to our Jewishness. And please God, the energy of Purim, we'll try our best, but the energy of Purim will bring about tremendous blessing and hopefully a very, very swift end and victorious end to this whole darkness that we find ourselves currently in. And we'll see the great miracles as they did in Purim and celebrate another Purim miracle. Yeah. Don't forget Sunday morning at 10:15 at Ariella's house, and everyone of Purim Sameach.
Sunday.
What is that?
Living on the 31st, so I'll